Let's give a warm welcome to Bryce S.
Yeah, Bryce.
Back at it again. Shit. All right, my name is Bryce. I'm an alcoholic.
Bryce.
I've been to several of these. As I recall, they usually fly people, you know, from across the country, and the one guy had a limo. The one I went to, and they put him up in a fancy hotel. I didn't get any of that treatment. I'm a little disappointed in you guys. You're kind of slipping, so y'all need to have one of the better committee meetings or something. But I am from out of town over the bridge, so I guess that's good enough to speak here for an anniversary. I live in St. Pete. Let's see, the basic stuff we have to go over. My sobriety date is 2002. I just celebrated 14 years. You guys are 15 years old. I've been coming here that long every once in a while, but I'm socially awkward, so big groups are kind of difficult for me to navigate. My home group is to the max. We're over on Beach Drive, like downtown St. Petersburg, right there by the water, in the dog park, Vinoy, that area. We meet on Sundays at 8 o'clock. Sponsor a couple guys. I've always been, hello. Sorry, everybody looks. That was funny. And I think that's why I'm still here today, is because of the people I've been able to work with throughout the years that keep that magic alive for me, you know, that remind me that this is real, you know, that this is magic, you know, that these steps and recovering from alcoholism, because I had all my miracles, you know, in the first couple of years. You know, life was new and brand new. Every day was special, and I was able to see it all very clearly, you know, the amazing, miraculous things that were happening in my life. But over the years, I feel like I ran out of those, other than the continued miracle of I'm still sober, and I'm not supposed to be, and that is a miracle, and I'll always be grateful for that. I'm supposed to be on a park bench somewhere with a quart of malt liquor, Mickey's preferably. In a brown bag, because I like that. It's kind of a koozie for me, and it keeps reflective glass from the police being able to see, and you know, sipping drinks and looking around and making sure there's no cops, because I don't like going to jail when I was drinking, because you can't drink in jail, and so I avoided that at all costs. But I always ended up going because I got slow. When I got drunk, I used to be real fast. I was a real fast kid. They could never catch me. My friend, this old biker, used to call me a gazelle. He'd say, "You just run from them police, man. They never catch you. You're like a gazelle." I'm like, "Yeah, man. I'm too fast, old man. That's." But, anyways, I don't know what I'm talking about. So, let's talk about drinking. Because that's my thing, man. That was my thing. That was my life. I was a weird kid. You know, from about 8 years old, I can remember experiencing a lot of fear. I thought about death a lot. You know, what happens when you die? You know, where do you go? I used to try to imagine what nothing feels like. And, you know, you get put in a little box and thrown out into outer space, and you just float for eternity. And that was terrifying to me. That's what I came up with. I had weird, obsessive, compulsive behaviors. Like, I could only sleep on one side of my body because I was afraid if I slept on my left side that all my blood would rush down and my heart would drown. Very irrational. So I'm alone with this stuff in my head as a little kid. I got nobody to tell. You know, I don't even know how I would explain those kind of things, anyways. But. And I was afraid of the dark, and this clown from Poltergeist that choked this little kid out in the movie. And my brother was aware of both of those things, my older brother. And he used to terrify me. And I had this Bozo ventriloquist doll that was a gift for Christmas, and I was terrified of it, and I kept it in the closet. And one night, I saw its face in the corner glowing, and the little mouth was going up and down, laughing and saying my name. And I flipped out and ran for the door. And I could hear him laughing as I was running away to get my mother, and he'd put like glow-in-the-dark paint on its face. Anyways, terrified kid. Third grade, it got weirder. I started skipping school, which seems mischievous and, you know, something very odd for a 10-year-old to do, but a bad 10-year-old, you could probably see. But the thing that was weird about my... my skipping was I was skipping school alone, and I would take my lunch money and go to the store at the Circle K in the morning, and then I would go in the orange groves, and I'd just sit in the orange groves and stare at ants all day and watch them and eat oranges, and I'd get citrus burn real bad. And I don't know if you ever had that, but if you eat about 15 oranges, you'll get a bad burn. So that's kind of where I was at. I didn't feel like I fit in at school, even though I was popular with, like, I wouldn't say popular. I always had, like, my best friend was always, like, the cool kid. And I always hated my best friends in school because they were always the cool kid who had, like the one kid, Steven, who knows, he might end up here. He was in karate, you know, so he had, like, training and stuff, and his parents could afford it. And he was my best friend. I hated him. My other buddy, after that, my next best friend, he was in football, and, you know, I hated him because of that, too. I never told him. I was always, you know, but I was always a resentful child, you know, because I had a fear of trying things like that and failing and things of that nature. So anyways, I turned 13. I guess I should start by saying my mother was a firefighter for the city of Tampa for 14 years, and that means she worked 24-hour shifts every other day, which meant, you know, well, she wasn't around anyways, even in between then, because she had her own stuff going on, her own stuff that I'm not going to get into. But, well, that basically it meant my older brother, who's 2 years older than me, was in charge, and he's a derelict. So I did what I wanted at 13 years old. You know, I was running the streets. We were living in Valley View townhomes out in Sefner or something out in Tampa way. But I started drinking. You know, I'd hang out with my brother and his older friends, and if I kept my mouth shut, they would feed me beers, you know. So I kept my mouth shut and just played it cool and got to drink. And I fell in love immediately with alcohol. I was like, this is cool. I want to do this all the time. And I did. I became a daily drinker at 13. In my neighborhood, it was very easy. You just pick an apartment, you know, and it was usually mine because all the older kids were using, I thought they wanted to be my buddy, but they were using us because no one was ever home, you know, so they'd come over and trash our place, and it was all good, you know. Every once in a while, my mother would decide that she would try to straighten herself out, maybe get a new husband or have another kid or something, you know, something to straighten her out, and she'd start trying to enforce rules, like coming home when the sun goes down, going to school, things of that nature. And I was already used to doing what I wanted, so by age 15, I was in eighth grade. I failed from the previous year. I really stopped going to school about sixth grade. But eighth grade is when I was able to stop going completely without the law being involved. I think my last day of school, I got in some trouble, and the principal said, you know, just leave. I'm not going to call any authorities or have anyone come looking for you. Just disappear, you know. And I was like, yes, this is what I've been trying to tell you people, you know. Just let me go. I got to be free, man. I got to see what's over that hill. You know, I was a very adventurous kid. Although I never went very far, my adventure was very local. But so anyways, my mom, with those rules and stuff, I couldn't do that, so I had to start running away from home, and I started sleeping outside in the neighborhood. Wasn't a big deal. It was a safe neighborhood, other than, you know, an occasional fight with your buddies when you drink too much, but that's normal where I come from anyway. But every once in a while, I'd get a little, you know, you get cold and tired and been partying for a few weeks, and I'd want to go home and clean up, and I'd do that and skedaddle. Well, eventually, my mom, I think the last time she threw me out, and so I went out on my own, and I went to 15th and Fletcher, a little town called Suitcase City. It's what we called it anyway. High transit area, transient, whatever. And I became a homeless person. I was 16 years old, 15, 16, and I was eating at the missions, or the mission is what it was called, and sleeping in camps and couch surfing and whatever else. And I was a daily drinker. I started experiencing DTs at that time. If I didn't have a morning drink, I would get real shaky, and it's my blood sugar. You know, I must have some kind of blood sugar thing, because I'm like shaking, you know, at 8 o'clock in the morning. So while my other friends were like nursing their hangovers, resting, sleeping, you know, in those morning hours, I was usually banging on their doors, asking them for change and a couple cigarettes, you know, so I could get some beer, you know, because I needed some alcohol. They didn't seem to need it, you know. But we partied hard, man, but there was some kind of weird difference between us, except my one buddy. Anyways, so no big deal. You know, all the sleeping outside and you know, being homeless and all that stuff wasn't really that big of a deal because I was drunk. You know, I can adjust to pretty much anything when I'm drinking. My real problem with drinking started for me, the unmanageability, was when I started trying to control it. And I was I was living with this band, and I was their, I don't know what you'd call me, I guess roadie or something, except it was conditional, because I was allowed to help them set up, but I was never allowed to help them tear down at the end of the evening, because I was tore down and they didn't want me touching their stuff, you know? So I would, you know, do that. I was actually, while I was living with them, I was on the run for a DUI that I'd gotten. I was 19 at this point, 18, and I got into a DUI accident. I hit a guardrail at about 70 miles an hour coming off an exit ramp home from a bar with my ex-girlfriend, and hit a guardrail. We were trapped in the car. They had to have the jaws of life, and bay flighted out of there. They put me on this chopper. They like cut all my clothes off. I'm naked in the rain, bleeding out, and they're putting me on this helicopter, and I'm like, I don't fly, bro. You can't put me on there. And they're like, you don't really have a choice, son. You know, and I'm like, in this helicopter, and the guy's like over me working on me with all these beeping things, and he's like, you know, asking me questions, you know, normal stuff like who's the president and the date and stuff, and I'm like, I'm asking him if I'm gonna die, you know, and he's like, stay with me, buddy, you're gonna be fine, and I'm like, that's what you tell everybody, man, I'm gonna die right here. But I didn't die. I woke up in the hospital, and I couldn't move my toes, and there was talk about possibly not being able to walk. But I ended up in a wheelchair for a year. And so that's when I went on this lam. I ran for a while from the police because they were after me. And this was bad. I'd never done anything like this bad, you know. And they like pulled guns on my brother while he was like naked in the shower from a back window, and came to his job, and came to, like, stalked all my friends and threatened them, and they were all derelicts, too, so there was a lot of, like, hey, we'll let you off for this if you tell us where Bryce is, type of stuff, and so I ran, and then I I was living with that band, and I was in Ybor City helping them out, and I saw this girl, and she was the one. She was wearing a Danzig T-shirt and these really tight black jeans and these boots up to her knees with buckles and stuff all over them, and I was like, yeah. We ended up falling in love, and the reason I know that I was in love with this woman was because she talked me into turning myself into the police, like of my own volition, if that's a word. Like, I went to the police and said, I am here, take me. And if you guys knew what kind of thinking I had back then, you would say, yeah, Bryce has lost it, because that was the last thing I would ever dream of doing. So that's where change started to begin for me, or the attempt to change. She ended up getting pregnant. I was on probation, which is a cruel joke for an alcoholic of my description, because I cannot do probation, man. I will take it every time, but I can't do it. I always get drunk and mess everything up, you know. Like, not showing up, not able to pay. I mean, at 50 community service hours out of 6 years of probation, I still didn't complete it. 50 hours, man, you know? But, so I ended up on house arrest and all kinds of stuff. So I started, she got pregnant. That's when I was going to be this new guy, you know, the guy who like gets a real job and you know, has a family and is different than my father and all that stuff, because I grew up with, you know, not knowing my father. And that's when it started getting bad for me, because I couldn't hold a job. I'd always get drunk, you know. She'd come looking for me, you know, to get the paycheck on Fridays, you know, because she knew there was like a window before I would spend too much, you know. We needed diapers and things like that, and here's the kind of guy I am. Like, one day, she told me to go to the store and get some diapers and gave me like $10. So I went and bummed like three diapers from a neighbor, and got a bunch of beers and came back. And she's like, what is wrong with you? And I'm like, no, we're good for the night, you know, we'll worry about, you know, the rest tomorrow. So there was a lot of that. There was, I couldn't hold a job because I would get drunk, or sometimes I'd be just so afraid to go because it was just too much. You know, I just couldn't handle society, you know. My drinking started getting worse. You know, she didn't want me drinking anymore. I tried slowing down is what I really did, and I was unable to do that for very often. I did a lot of not coming homes, and then I'd come home 3 or 4 days later, and she'd say, where have you been? And I always had this thing, I've been in the country, you know, and she'd be like, what do you mean the country? I'm like, there's no phones in the country, you know, I can't call you from out there. And then I blame it on my friends who took me to the country and left me there, you know. Well, her parents had let us move in, and her father had gotten me a job and done everything possible. I've never had a lack of people try to help me when I was drinking, and I let them all down horribly, you know. We ended up homeless because of my drinking one night, and we were pushing the stroller down the street with the kids. She already had a child, little Darian, that was a couple years old, and my son, and we were homeless because of me. And she's like, well, I can go stay at my parents, but you know, they said you're a loser and you're not allowed to stay there. And I was like, how dare those people judge me, you know? They don't understand, you know? I had this thing about nobody knew what it was like to be me, kind of thing. And so we ended up, that's when I, shortly thereafter, I asked her for couple bucks to get a beer, and she looked at me and was like, you know, after everything that's happened, all you can think about is a beer, you know. And she gave me the money because, you know, I get crappy acting if I don't get what I want, and she's just like, take it all, you know. So that's kind of where I was at, you know. I wasn't doing too well. One day I went out on a bender, came home a week later, and we had the mailbox slot on a door, and I knew I was pretty much done. We were together about 3 years when she finally threw in the towel. So I knocked on the door, the locks were changed, she wouldn't let me in, and the little thing popped up, and all I could see was her eyeballs, and she's like, you don't live here anymore, Wayne does, and I was like, I lost it, you know. I started banging on the door and losing, you know, crying and banging, trying to fight everybody in the house. All the golf carts are pulling up at the maintenance men with their 1,000 keys jingling that go to nothing. What's going on here? And I'm like, shut up. I'm trying to save my family, you know. And she's like, you know the routine, take a walk around the block and your stuff will be outside. So I did. And I come back and my stuff's outside, and I had this acoustic guitar case. It was a very embarrassing story. But every time she would throw me out, I would pack my dirty clothes in this acoustic guitar case. I never had a guitar. I could never keep one long enough. She'd either break them or I'd pawn them or whatever. And so I'm carrying this guitar case, and I find the closest bar I can. You know, I got a couple of bucks in my pocket. God, that was a horrible day, man. I walked like 4 miles just to get home to get thrown out, and it was like August. And so I go into this bar and I put my guitar case down, and there's a couple other guys in there having a morning drink, and which I was like, yes, you know, I like people to drink in the morning so I don't feel like something's wrong with me, you know. And the guys were like, hey man, you play guitar? And I was like, I sure do, man. Like a pro, you know. And they're like, why don't you break it out and play us a tune, you know. And I was like, nah, I got old lady problems right now, man. I'm just not feeling it, and I'm just like pretending like I got something going on, you know. And I didn't. I was homeless, you know. So I went back to the street for a few years and here and there, and you know, I pretty much gave up on life at that point, other than my new primary purpose was to make her and her new boyfriend's life a living hell every chance I got, which I did. Me and him had several altercations. One in particular altercation, I found him at this biker bar called Born to Ride, which I used to frequent, and I walk up to fight him, and as soon as I do, he just immediately breaks my nose, and I'm like, this is not good. I'm bleeding everywhere. I'm drunk, you know. And so then we get on the ground, you know, and I'm finally getting the best of him. You know, I got him in a headlock, and I'm just working, knotting his head up. And then all of a sudden, I'm just death from above. I'm just getting pounded from somebody, and I look up, and it's my kid's mom. And she's saying, let him go, and just punching me, drilling me in the head. And I'm just completely, I don't get it, man. I'm like, I'm trying to save our family. Like, trying to, you know, I'm doing this for us. And she just, it was over, man. But I was just still holding on to this thing, you know. And so that was our relationship, me and his. I got to make amends to him, which was really awkward, because he thought we were gonna fight, and it got really weird. But I ended up making amends to him, and you know, I told him I was pissed off because he was a better man than me, and I thanked him for being a father to my son because I wasn't there, you know. And he ended up like making a little amends to me, you know, for some of the stuff that he said, and we both walked out of there, you know, being able to look each other in the eye, and that was cool. So anyways, yeah, that was that. So after that, I went on this, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, I think it's Nicolas Cage in Leaving Las Vegas, but he goes on this mission to drink himself to death, and I hadn't seen that movie, but that's exactly what I was doing. I was trying to drink myself to death, and I was amazed every day that I woke up in the morning that I was still alive. I couldn't believe it. The amounts of alcohol that I was drinking, and I don't eat when I drink either, so I go long periods of time without eating because that part just shuts down and all I do is drink. I'm like like a light switch. It's either on or off. There's no in-between for me. So anyways, I kept waking up, you know, and I'm waking up, what, 155 pounds, sleeping in a ball, waking up in a ball, terrified, you know, the four horsemen they talk about in our literature, bewilderment, frustration, despair, what's the other one? Terror. That stuff. That was what I was living with. And I would try to shut my eyes back and go to sleep and just try to have, you know, at least in sleep there was a little bit of peace, but my body demanded alcohol, so I would have to get up and take care of that. I ended up hanging out with this girl and getting a new girlfriend, and I had a new lease on life. And I got this new, I got a lucrative job opportunity with a small company that was growing rapidly, and I was like, man, I got another shot at life. Maybe it's not hopeless. And well, they invited me to a party, a birthday party for an employee, and I was very new. It was like the third week, you know, so I declined and told them I had stuff to do, which I did, and I just know that if you get me out on a Wednesday night, I was trying to control my drinking at that point. I could stay drunk at the house, but you can't take me out because then you get shots involved and I'm gone again. I'm on a bender. So anyways, by the end of the day, I realized that I was kind of being, you know, I should be a little nicer. These people are really trying to, you know, be nice to me, and it's this girl's birthday. So anyways, my girlfriend at the time comes to pick me up, and I tell her the deal. You know, here's the deal. I give her all of my money in my wallet, and I tell her to give me $10. And this is what I'm going to drink, just this $10. And I'm going to go out with these people. They're trying to be nice, you know. So I go out with them. I drink that $10 up in 5 minutes at this place called Biff Burger. And they had plastic bottles, which I was like, wow, this is weird, plastic beer bottles. But anyways, so the guys were like, you want another beer, man? I'm like, you know, I'm good. I don't have any money. And they're like, well, we'll loan you some money. I'm like, and then I was like, oh, okay, yeah, sure. So anyways, I'll pay you back double on Friday, you know, at the job that I'm about to not have. And so they didn't know me, you know, and we partied hard that night. And I woke up in the morning, and the answer machine's going off. I can hear my boss on there, my new boss, and he's like, everybody else is here. Where are you? And I got this pit bull. And I have no idea. I brought home things before, but never an actual dog. So this dog's licking my face. The phone's ringing. I'm like, oh my God, I need a drink. I had to start drinking. And next thing you know, the cops are there because I got in a fight with my upstairs neighbor because they were playing music too loud. And so I held them at bay. And then shortly after that, I called them on my neighbor, and the police are like, we've been trying to get to you all day, and now you're calling. It was crazy. Anyways, I ended up losing my place to live, my job, and my girlfriend in that same day. So I went to this store across the street where I had a tab, you know, malt liquor tab. This guy, like, ordered special for me, special extra cases of Mickey's malt liquor for me because I liked it so much. And I was like, I need, you know, 5 or 6 quarts, you know, I got to go to Tampa and cash his check. I didn't have a check. I was moving on. So I went back to Tampa. And I actually made that amends too in sobriety. I actually went by that store when I was working for this lawn service. And I walk in, and it's the same guy from like 8 years or something, 4 or 5, yeah. And he's like, hey, where have you been? And I'm like, what? He's like, you said you were going to Tampa to cash the check. And I'm like, oh, he's like, yeah, 5 quarts of beer. And I'm like, oh, like, that's what I need to pay? He's like, yeah. He knew exactly, like, how much money it was and everything. So I paid him. I was like, hey, that's an amends. I hadn't even, like, taken the steps yet. But that's one off the list. So anyways, yeah, it just got worse from there. I ended up back in Tampa at my brother's house, and my brother, I asked him for a place to stay, and he said, you know, man, you can't keep coming here every 6 to 8 months when you screw everything up, expecting me to give you a place to crash until you figure out your next scheme or plan or whatever it is, and so you can't stay here. And I was like, well, you know, whatever, bro. And he's like, you can sleep in the yard. And so I slept in the yard, so he wasn't a complete, you know, jerk. And I woke up that morning, and I was in bad shape, man. I was out of gas. I needed a drink bad. I had a little bit of change, enough, you know, just enough change to get something, you know, some Silver Thunder or some garbage. So I go to the store, and I'm just in there. I feel like I'm going to die right there, you know, and I need this beer. And I'm looking around. I'm in this line, and there's all these lights, and it was just very surreal. And I'm looking down the line of people, and there's all these people, all these men, and they're like wearing work boots, and they got like coffees and donuts and orange juice, and I'm just like, man, that's what I want. I've been trying to be, you know, my whole life. That's what I want to be, you know. And I'm literally like putting money, change on the counter, because I can't even, because I'm shaking so bad, and having him count it, because I can't focus, because I'm so all over the place in my mind, and buying a beer, and I'm completely, utterly humiliated and ashamed of what I have to do, but I don't have a choice. You know, I need a drink. So later that day, I called a lady, and I was like, hey, actually, it was my probation officer. No, I called Parr. I'd heard very good things about this place called Parr. They, like, my buddy highly recommended them. He's like, you go to Parr, man, and they give you a bunch of these little pills, and you just, like, drool on yourself for a few days, and then you're good. You know, you don't have to DT, you know? And I'm like, oh, because my self-detoxes were getting really iffy. You know, I didn't trust him anymore. You know, I used to have a good method of procedure that I came up with of my own that worked for me, but it stopped working. And I was just too afraid. So anyways, I called them and I was like, hey, you guys got a bed there? And they were like, no, we don't have a bed, but if you want to leave your information, we'll contact you within 4 days and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, man, I don't have 4 days, you know. Couple of beers could change everything for me, and you know, 4 days I could be on another bender. You know, that window of opportunity to get sober for me was very, very small, because I don't get to like choose when I stop drinking, when I start. Like, alcohol decides when that is over, and I had that moment right then, so I needed to do something right then. And I was like, well, I don't have, you know, I know myself too well, you know. I know that alcohol is my master at this point. So I was like, I don't know, is there anything else you can offer me? And they said that there's a homeless detox shelter out in St. Petersburg called the Turning Point. And I said, well, give me that number. And I called an ex-girlfriend who took pity on me and offered to drive me there. And I had a little tiny bag, like a little Publix bag of dirty clothes, and she got me a carton of cigarettes, which I don't know about y'all, man, but cigarettes are the only thing that kept me at that place. If I wouldn't have had cigarettes, bro, I would have had to leave there to go get cigarettes. And so I was always real big on, throughout the years of detoxes, bringing cigarettes, man. You just keep a guy there one more day with some smokes, you know, and get through it. So anyways, I go there, and I'm like, okay, where's the medication? And they're like, well, we don't do that here, you know. You go and lay on this mat on the floor in this big area, and if you don't die in 4 days, we'll put you in a room. And so I was like, this is bad. This is bad. People are falling out, having, you know, seizures and stuff, and it was horrible, man. I sat there and shook and sweated and had night terrors the whole time. It's very, very little sleep, but I didn't completely fall out and ended up getting a room. And then my job was to clean these mats that took this kind of daily abuse from drunks coming in, which is a hell of a job, man. You just suit up. But anyways, they were going to release me from there after a month, and I was terrified, man. I was afraid to look over the fence because I knew what was waiting for me. You know, alcohol was waiting for me, and I didn't trust myself. I'm the guy who gets drunk on the way home from the hospital, you know, who says there's no hope for me, you know. I was just hiding, you know, hoping for something, you know. So they let me out, and they sent me gave me some directions to a little place. What do you call them? A halfway house. And I remember I was walking out, and I was walking down by the interstate, and I look up, and I see this giant Budweiser billboard, and it's got this really attractive lady on it, and this really attractive guy on it, and they're smiling, and they got their beer, and I was just looking at it, and I'm like, I'm screwed, man. Like, that doesn't happen to me when I drink anymore. It did for a long time, but it doesn't happen for me, you know, that obsession, you know. I'm drinking myself to death in a ditch, but I can't imagine life without alcohol because someday I'm going to have fun again, you know. I just need to figure this thing out or whatever, get the right this or right that. So that's where my journey into AA began, you know. I was at the halfway house. I worked at a labor pool for a little while, and then I got me a pizza job 20 hours a week, making pizzas, throwing pie at Domino's. It's hand-tossed, believe it or not. And it was awesome. You know, I had food every night. Everybody at the halfway house loved me because I could, you know, I had a hustle. You know, I got pizza. What do you got? You know, get some shampoo, some cigarettes, get you a pizza, you know. That's how it works. And so I did really well there, you know. I went to meetings all the time. I did very well. I do very well in controlled environments. I always have. You put me in jail, I excel. I'm like GD class. I'm like doing push-ups every night, working in the kitchen, you know, shining my shoes with toothpaste, which I actually did tonight because they were really dirty. And I was like, oh yeah, when we were in jail, we used to shine our shoes with toothpaste. And it's great for other things too. It's good for pimples. You put it on pimples. It's good for a mild adhesive if you want to hang some pictures on your bunk. So, but problem is, you know, is I could quit drinking, you know. But the problem is, they always let me out of jail, and then I'd be drinking again. But anyways, so. I did pretty well, you know. I made it 10 months, and then I couldn't take it anymore, and I ended up drinking. And then I picked up 6 more white chips. I was going to a 12-step room, but you only practiced a couple steps. It was I guess Bill W. refers to it as two-stepping. And that didn't work for me. It was working for a lot of the other guys, but it didn't work for me. Even my sponsor was confused because I was doing everything this guy told me, you know, multiple meetings a day. I was sponsoring a guy. I was chairing meetings, making coffee, cleaning up cigarette butts, everything a good little sponsee would do. I was doing that. But inside I was miserable, you know, and I couldn't take it anymore. And I eventually drank. And I immediately was drinking on the floor again. And I was astounded of how quickly it happened. I didn't even get to have I got one good night, and then the next day, as soon as I woke up in the morning, I needed a drink. I couldn't even believe it. I thought it'd be like a couple of weeks before I get back to my bad drinking, but I immediately went right back to progressive drinking, and I learned what they say when it gets worse, never better, you know, or you pick up where you left off. I experienced that, so there's nothing in me that thinks that there's something left for me in drinking. However, that doesn't matter. That doesn't mean I will not drink again. Because the obsession is the real twisted part of this thing. And that's what haunted me, you know, was the obsession. I had to leave that group and get a different sponsor. I'd given up on Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'd made some friends hanging around, and they talked. They were like, hey, we got this guy, you should check him out. One of our other guys left there and is getting sponsored by him. And so I was like, all right, I'll give him a few minutes, you know. And this dude, he was a drunk, man. and he was way worse than me, but he knew, he spoke the language, you know, he knew what it was like, and I bought it, man. He sold it, and I bought it. I mean, he was like, we're driving around, he's showing me places, he tried to commit suicide, and I'm like, that's a great place, I'm surprised nobody found you. He's like, I know, it's weird. And I'm like, it's not just a cry for help, this dude's like the real deal, you know. So he said, he's like, so have you done the program? I'm like, oh yeah, man. You know, and I told him all those things that I told you that I was actively doing, which are wonderful things. I encourage new guys to do them, but they weren't enough to for me to recover from a hopeless state of mind and body, from alcoholism. I needed to do work to do that. I needed to start a four-step, you know, and that's where it began for me. I started that four-step, and the four-step was a lot of me writing something down and throwing it across the room and saying, this is stupid. You know, that was my four-step. This is stupid. And then I'd leave it over there for a couple of days, and I'd walk back and forth by it, you know, and then I'd pick it up and write something again. I still read it occasionally, and I'm, like, cussing all over it, like, calling people all kinds of stuff. I'm like, it was pretty rough, but I got through it, and I had a lot of question marks, too, and where am I at fault, because I couldn't see my part, you know. So I ended up doing my fifth step with my sponsor, and that was a long day, and it was the most educational and freeing experience. That night, when I went to sleep, it was like the gear stopped turning for the first time in my life. You know, I just had a reprieve from my thinking and all that stuff. You know, and one guy knows everything about me. There's just one guy out there that knows my whole truth, you know, good and bad. And that saved my life, man. I was like, I went back to that group after I did my fifth step, and I was like, you're killing people here. Anybody who can't take it, come with me. I'm going to be outside. And guys would come up and be like, bro, I love what you say in the meetings, but my sponsor tells me to stay away from you or I'm going to get drunk. And I'm like, they fear me. This is awesome. We're going to take this place over, you know? And but it didn't last long because my passion got in the way, you know, and the message got lost. And I turned into an angry, big book thumper guy. Anyways, after that, so I told you something about the ninth step, you know. I started making amends right after I did my fifth step, man. And although I was terrified to do them, I had a desire to do them, and I started knocking on doors in Tampa, and I made amends to the girl that I was in the car accident with, to her family, for what I put them through. You know, she broke her knee, and her family was, you know, I had, you know, they experienced an amount of fear. I asked them what I could do to make things right, you know, and with them, and they said, well, you can listen to us. So they put on a sermon, a Catholic sermon, for conversion for me for like an hour, and I said I will, you know, take that in consideration, and another check mark, you know, and I'm off making my other amends. I made amends to that guy, and you know, eventually my child's mother, and I got to, you know, slowly started being able to see my kid. You know, it started with a weekend visit, you know, supervised with her, and then it gradually became weekends, and then it became every summer for, you know, 10 years. And me and my son, man, we're very close. And that's been one of the biggest gifts I've been given besides my sobriety. Um, 10, 11, and 12, I haven't done anything perfectly. My sponsor said the other night that this isn't about necessarily being good, it's about staying sober. And I've made some horrible decisions throughout the years, and I've learned immensely, and I've gained a lot of wisdom, I'll just call it that, because it sounds cooler, you know, from my follies and mishaps. But, you know, the biggest thing for me is remaining willing to grow along spiritual lines. You know, I'm practicing spiritual principles. I'm not a spiritual dude. Like, I'm not the guy who's like, oh, let's go to a drum circle and hula hoop, throw fire and stuff. You know, that's not who I am. God bless those people, but I'm a realist. I like think the worst case scenario, like immediately I'm like, this is all going to just burn to hell, you know? What's the point, you know? But I'm willing to practice spiritual principles, you know, and I'm willing to grow along spiritual lines, and I'm willing to extend my hand, you know, to somebody and give them the most valuable thing I have to offer, which is my time and my experience, you know. So it's been 14 years I've been able to make it this long, and that's a big deal for me because I don't feel much different, you know, from when I first came in. I just know more of how messed up I really am and how much this program and a reliance on a power greater than myself is important. You know, because of myself, I am nothing. I am not the good-natured person that wakes up. You know, I always wanted to be the guy who wakes up in the morning, you know, and be like, I'm going to have a great day, you know, good positive vibes, you know. Maybe put one of those daily affirmation things on Facebook that all my friends send me, and I always hide them, you know. So I'm like, don't put that on my page. But I need help. I need a little help. I need a little HP, you know. I need a little prayer. I need a little meditation. I need to look at some literature. I need to like think of somebody besides myself, things like that to get me out of that that type of thinking. So congratulations to your group for surviving this long. There's a lot of new faces. I recognize one face, maybe two from back in the day, because I came here a lot, throughout the years, but I remember when this was a new group. But anyways, thanks for letting me talk. So that's it.